Major Hogan, Reel 5.
About a few days later, we were told to make our way to Kalaw, another hill station in the Shan States, a holiday hill station. From there, to move down the road, however, whatever means we could, to Thazi, and then back to Mactila. From Mactila, we were taken by road, further south. From Mactila, by road to Pimina, and there we got our orders, and I flew and was dropped in the Ye area of the Tenasserim, with a view to covering Three Pagoda Pass and the Cock Creek Pass. I was told vaguely that there were four other groups in the area, and I would be the fifth. We did not know it at the time, but I guess the powers that be must have, that the war would be coming to an end, i.e., the atom bomb. I can't say we had very much action. As far as our group was concerned, we were overlooking or near prisoner of war camps. We had been given and were dropped previously MNB 693, quinine, mapocrine, gentian violet, bandages, boric powder, and we had to wait the signal to move into the camps to give these medical supplies to the doctors to treat these poor, starving prisoners of war. On one or two occasions, I went into the camps at 1 or 2 in the morning, taking with me MNB 693, mepocrine, quinine, but no bandages and gentian violet, because that would show up, and iodine, that would show up, and the Japs would know that medical supplies were being smuggled in. I did this 2, possibly 3 times. And I was reprimanded for it.
Why?
In case these medicines were found and the reprisals for the doctors. That's what I was told. And then there was a question of wait for further orders. The next thing we knew, war was over. This is August 45, and we were to make our way to Moulmein. From Moulmein, the five of us were flown to Singapore for what they thought would be another operation against the communists in Malaya, which eventually was the emergency for us to make contact with the communists, because if you remember correctly, we were supplying arms and ammunition to them. And the idea was to get them on our side and get back some of these guns and ammunition that we had given them. However, when I was there, they had to find work for us, and I was put on internal security duties in the building in which they were going to effect the surrender of the Japanese, the ceremony. And I was given the duty of, I think, the north wing of this huge building, looking into every room for anyone can hide security. And I think there were four officers, four of us, captains, sort of north, south, east, west, and with our responsibility. And we were given a motley lot of other ranks from Indians, British, Gurkhas, Malay scouts, just, you know, on the job. About 150 men per officer. And then came the signing of the peace, and I managed to get a decent uniform, complete with Sam Black, and got into the main chamber where they were signing the peace treaty.
Sam Brown, the Belgian?
Sam Black, because we are rifle regiment. We don't wear brown. Sam Black. And got into the main signing of the...
What impression did the Japanese make who were signing the surrender?
Still very arrogant. In that... Still very arrogant, proud... And if they had their way, they would not have surrendered. As you know, there were two schools of thought, one wanting to fight to the bitter end, and the others to get the Emperor Hirohito to call a truce. But quite frank with you, that stage of my life, these things never interested me or worried me at all. But they were rather arrogant and strutted around, but very well disciplined. In other words, I would say they didn't have to tell them what to do. They did it, and they stood up at the right time and said, whether they had been coached or I don't think so. They gave respect for senior rank, of which most of us were generals and admirals, and they were major generals. And they gave the respect that was due to them. And they were given the respect that they were due, because if you look over there, they had escorts sitting behind them, and most of the escorts were about the equivalent rank, or if not higher, than what they were.
This is the photograph.
Yes, you see? See them? You get a very high ranking officers. See, that's a full colonel. So they were given a fairly good treatment. After about 2-3 weeks in Singapore, which I must say came back to life overnight, more than any other place I had seen in Rangoon, and which stayed sort of subdued. Singapore, just nightlife, Chinese restaurants open, dancing girls, neon lights. At that time, neon lights were quite rare, but a lot of these Chinese lanterns with electric lights. Night markets, night bazaars, they call them, opened up. And the amazing part of it, Japanese biros. I bought my first Japanese biro in Singapore, gold-plated thing. The first biro I ever bought. But how would ever a Japanese biro got to Singapore in 1945? I don't know. I remember buying two of them, losing one, and I kept one for ages and ages. What else? Then we were flown back via Yeo, Penang. There we go. Sumatra, Penang, island of Penang, Maulmain, Rangoon. Stopping all the way, delivering mail. High officials, civilian and military, and picking them up on the way and taking them back, some sick, some not so sick, to Rangoon. When I get back to Burma, we find that they are forming what they call class battalions, i.e. Kachin rifles, Chin rifles, Karen rifles, and Burma rifles, and by classes. So I am posted to the 2nd Battalion, the Karen Rifles, which is in the Delta, Basin.
Have they not had class units before that?
No. But before that, they had, excuse me saying so, but very few Burmans in the Burma Army itself. They were mostly Karens, Chins, Kachins, Gurkhas, and believe it or not, Punjabi Muslims and Sikhs, who were on the frontier force. And the military police was mainly Gurkhas. and very few Burmans. If they had any Burmans, they were mostly drivers and clerks. Now they were forming class battalions, two battalions of in each class, i.e. the Kachins and Karens, and about 10 battalions of Burma Rifles, who were mainly in the plains in Burma. We were in Basin. We had to clear up a few Japanese that were still in the delta there. Some had even intermarried with some of the local girls and were farming. And our job then was to receive back all the old soldiers who didn't come out to India. They were given the option of going back to their families. Some deserted in early in the war. Some were given the option. However, we had to interrogate them and classify them black, white, or gray. White were allowed to rejoin the Burma army as such. Gray were paid off. And black were just sent off without any money at all. And this was unfortunately a summary decision which our colonel had to do after the interrogation officers had given him a report in the form of a court of inquiry. In between, we were training up to company level. Quite a few of the regulars who had come back to us and putting us back on a regular basis, i.e. Saturday morning parades and a little bit of the whole pre-war bull, which I agreed was very good for discipline. And life was just wonderful. Sport, shooting, physical education, parades, further education for the troops, and we were getting on to very little internal security duties in Basin itself. We were now in Karen country, which was fairly well disciplined. We then moved to Mektila, and we had a camp on the lake, a tented camp. Where, as I say again, most of it was parade, sport, good food, more sport, a little bit of club life. We were on the lake, sailing, swimming, and I was then posted to north to Mamio in the first Burma Army Officers Training Unit as demonstration company commander. That was in 1947. Burma got independence on the 4th of January 1948, and then, unfortunately, the rot set in. All the British officers were replaced by young Burmese officers who had no wartime experience. A lot of us were superseded in rank.
So was this because you'd been trained by the British?
Yes, we were classified as British-trained Burmese officers and not wanted under establishment. So I could see the writing on the wall. This is independence. And in the year that I was there, I took my release in 1949. I'm sorry and very sorry to say the army deteriorated in discipline. I'm talking about discipline and the hail fellow well met attitude of the young Burmese officer. He wanted to be a pal to his men, but when the time came on the border to chase Chinese bandits across the border, he'd find himself alone. The men thought it wasn't prudent to chase 500 Chinese bandits, but there you are.
Did you have to go to the border yourself?
I went once to the border myself, and we did very well indeed, and 30 of us chased about 500 of them. They were literally, they called themselves Chinese communists, they're not. They were bandits for whatever they could get. They were opium smugglers, which is now on thing. And they were the old Chinese warlords of the old days, where they ruled with a rod of iron. But as you may know, the Chinese were claiming about 400 square miles of North Burma at that time. They said originally the China border went right through there. But nothing could be done about it. Actually, at that time, there was about 100,000 nationalist troops, Chiang Kai-shek's lot, in the Shan states. and I went with a Brigadier Blake and flew over their encampment, and it would have taken about 10 times the strength of the Burma army to dislodge them. Because 100,000 Chinese are a hell of a lot of Chinese troops, or any troops for that matter, to be dislodged. So that's what they were scared of, that they'd take the North Burma. Yes, but this lot were literally the old warlords taking advantage of the situation and rape, pillage, anything. Just walk into a village and take everything they want to, and nothing could stop them. But there you are. The Burma army itself, then and even now, couldn't do a thing about it. The smuggling is still going on. And I'm afraid if you've ever seen an opium, you ever heard of these opium smugglers?
Yes.
They go 2,000-3,000 strong, with about 4,000 heavily armed guards, and nothing will stop them. Their opium trade comes first. I now got married, and I couldn't get out fast enough. And I took advice from a very senior British officer with whom I served during the war, Brigadier Sir Bernard Ferguson, and he wrote to me and told me, get out however I can, because if I don't, and if I'm locked up, I'd be locked up for life. So I went to Steel Brothers again, who were the shippers, dropped my father's name into the lap of the young assistant there who happened to know him, who worked under him in 1935, just before my dad died, and he got me a passage out on the SS Salween.
Well, lots of Karens doing the same at that time.
Unfortunately, no. They all went up to the border there. There could be very many more Karens over here in England, but unfortunately, no. They all went to the Siam border then, as it is, up into Kareni, and that's where they formed the state, the Kortule state, Kareni state, which is in existence right now.
Could I ask you, going back to the war, what your own attitude was to the Japanese enemy?
First-class soldier, tough. My way of thinking then, well disciplined, in that if they were ambushed, their small arms fire would be against you in a matter of seconds, And within 15, 20 seconds, if they had mortars, their mortars would be in action. I said this on the World of War series. I say it again. They must have been one of the finest soldiers that I know of. I haven't fought against the Germans, but the Japs. But we didn't know it at the time of their samurai code of conduct with prisoners, etc. We couldn't understand their brutality. Because I must say, the British soldier, the Gurkha soldier, and the Karen is very generous in victory. You'll have to stop my men from giving them a cigarette or sharing their water with a prisoner, whereas I suppose the Japanese other rank wouldn't think of giving you water or food until such time as his officer said so. But I had to stop the men because we were short of water and giving a dying man. But we were very generous in victory, whereas they were just the opposite. Of course, we didn't quite understand their code of conduct. Even now, I cannot understand it. I'm sorry. If you're a human being, one human that cannot treat another human. But there again, you had the Germans being so cruel to the Jews, and they are Westerners. So there you are. But as far as tough marching, fighting next morning, you couldn't beat them. You couldn't beat them. Many times we were shooting them and killing them, but admiring them, because we knew that they had marched 20 miles overnight to get to us, and here they were putting up one terrific fight. And if anybody could come in on the bayonet, they could. Banzai. At you.
What did you think of the Chindit achievement in Burma?
As far as I was concerned, we were wonderful. We had diverted quite a few divisions. We had cut their line of communication. We hadn't done everything they wanted us to do. We couldn't. But I think, as a humble lieutenant, that we did do some good. We all of us felt, even to today, we all feel that the Chindits must have done something. We must have helped even the Kohima Imphal battles by sitting on their line of communications. If the Japs could have got up more reinforcements, more arms, more ammunition, more field guns, they would have taken Kohima. But I think we were the thorn in their side. And we felt that we had done our bit to help end the war in Burma.
Coming back to the organization of the Burma Rifles and this business of having a Kachin unit, a Karen unit, Chin unit, and so on, would it have been easily possible to mix them all together in the same platoons and so on?
Pre-war, they did have some battalions with a Chin company, Kachin company, Karen company. I would have liked that. Different races and different companies, possibly, and then you get the rivalry. Now we had inter-battalion rivalry, and because of the situation, we couldn't get together often enough. But if we had a Burmese battalion, a Burmese company, Kachin company, Karen company, even football, sport, shooting, everything, I think it would have been better for the army itself, in the long run, in the long term.
But did things like language and different types of food and so on stand in the way of people mixing together?
Not food. Burma, they're not vegetarians, they're not beef eaters, they eat anything. A Burman or a Burmese or a Karen or Kachin would eat everything. Language might have been, but in 3 months they seemed to pick up the language, the Burmese as a... Most of the plainsmen, or the Chins, or the Karens, or the Kachins, could speak Burmese. It's only the people right up in the hills who wouldn't be able to speak. But it would be surprised how they could pick up the language so quickly. We had Gurkha recruits come straight from eastern Nepal. In 3 months' time, they were speaking jolly good Burmese.
So Burmese was the lingua franca of the
Burma, yeah.
Not English?
Not English. Even the British officers had to learn Burmese. They had to pass a oral and Roman script test within 3 months of joining battalion. Matter of fact, the second lieutenant was not promoted to captain until he passed that exam of elementary Burmese. And of course, when it came to being promoted to major, this is talking about pre-war, he had to pass fairly advanced tests.
Is your mother tongue English or Karen?
My mother tongue is Karen, but I went to an English school in Rangoon. And believe it or not, my second language was Burmese, because of the school I went to in Burma, the diocesan school.